This is the Coconetics Podcast. Episode 39, recorded June 30th, 2012. WWDC, what next? Well, as it goes, I don't have much prepared today, so let's just begin with some news that Apple came out with right after WWDC. Apple sent to all developers an email detailing some changes. App and in-app catalog reports now available. Catalog reports provide you with extended information for all your apps and in-app purchases. To view and generate reports, go to the Catalog Reports module in iTunes Connect. New reports can be generated only once every 24 hours. The report you get gives you one big list of everything you have on iTunes Connect. All apps, all in-app purchases. Apple seems to be afraid of too much vanity, and so they limit the generation of this report to once per day. Then there's iTunes Connect 2.0, which is now available on the App Store. Actually, there was a very cute scene. There was a session at WWDC where they were actually releasing iTunes Connect Mobile 2.0 with iTunes Connect Mobile 2.0. So he was kind of releasing the app while he was demonstrating it on stage. So he pushed a button, and much to the amusement of all spectators, a few minutes later, it's became available on the App Store. So that was kind of a little bit meta. iTunes Connect Mobile allows you to access all your app information, customer reviews, and sales data on your iPhone, iPad, or iPod Touch. You can now also access the metadata for your apps, designate favorite apps for easy tracking, and provide access for traditional user roles. The update to iTunes Connect Mobile already became available during WWDC. I just told you, and several developers have mentioned to me that they especially like the feature that you can now do a manual release of a held back app from the phone. Already told you also, you know, when the app is in pending developer release status. So if you wonder, I wrote this sentence way before I'm making this episode now, so don't wonder if something feels odd. So, okay, next item here. High resolution app icon and newsstand cover art for Retina display. Starting in July, newly submitted iOS apps, especially noting newly submitted iOS apps, require high resolution icons and cover art. Large icons and newsstand cover art must have a minimum resolution of 1024 by 1024 pixels. To change your app icons or cover art, go to the Manage Your Applications module on iTunes Connect. For more information, see the Custom Icon and Image Creation Guidelines in the iOS Developer Library. There we were happily creating 512 by 512 artwork, and now it turns out we have to go back and recreate everything at the higher resolution. Apparently there's some place in iOS 6, still under NDA, where these high-res icons will be used. Anyway, you should be creating your icons with a resolution independent vector art program anyway. This serves as a reminder to that. On June 22nd, Apple added app stores for 32 new countries, and since we all have time, I'm going to read them to you. There will be a test later. Albania, Benin, Bhutan, Burkina Faso, Cambodia, Cape Verde, Chad, Congo, Fiji, Gambia, Guinea-Bissau, Kyrgyzstan, Laos, Liberia, Malawi, Mauritania, Micronesia, Mongolia, Mozambique, Namibia, Nepal, Palau, New Guinea, that's how you say it in English, Sao Tome e Principe, Seychelles, Sierra Leone, Solomon Islands, Swaziland, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, Ukraine, Zimbabwe. I find it quite amusing to see certain countries in this list, even some that I thought to be imaginary ones from romance novels. Yes, Micronesia, I'm looking at you. Most amusing of all of this is that with the new countries located in Africa, it's now for the first time easier to buy apps than to be able to find a clean glass of water. Oh well, if we make a killing selling apps because of these additions, then we might just as well donate some for charity water. Problem solved. So, well, that's it for the kind of news I had prepared while in my hotel room at WWDC. I wrote a blog post for every day that I was there. Since there's everything under NDA there, I couldn't actually tell you about the nice things we learned there. But I kind of described all the surroundings. And if you are at WWDC the second time, you get way more relaxed about certain things. So, for example, you don't kind of have an urge anymore to try to go to all the parties there. It turned out some of the parties I went, more or less by accident, were not really so great. Yeah, even the ones where you had notice months in advance and you had to register and they were sold out was actually really crappy. Yeah, I'm not naming any names. Spotify. Mike Ash was cool, but the rest of the party was actually quite crappy. Yeah, just some cold pizza, one keg of beer for all the people coming. Well, it was nice. It was in an office of IGN, some blah 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 gaming network publication. So they were having arcade machines sitting at the sides. That was kind of a neat touch. But I was sorely disappointed by this party, actually. Better luck next year. One party that was really great was the one from Square, which was on the last day. So after WWDC, we headed over there. And at first, I thought I was meeting one of the iOS guys there, kind of in private. Yeah, we'll have a small gathering. But it turns out the Square offices, you wouldn't believe how large they are just looking at the lobby, because the lobby is like a small cubic area where a security guard sits and basically just wide enough to have an entrance to one elevator. And you take up this elevator, I can't remember which floor, and you come in, it looks like a lounge center that you would find at NASA or something. Totally amazing. So many people were there already. And it turns out Square seems to be having some sort of social gathering every week. And they just enlarged it slightly to accommodate additional guests from WWDC. But it seems to be the case that every Friday, is it? They have a presentation from Jack Dorsey, who's their CEO. And if you know this name, well, he's also the CEO of Twitter. So people working there tell me he's working two full-time jobs. I wonder how he keeps so fit, because he's thin and looks healthy, even though he's got two jobs. But, well... People at Square are really excited to be working there. It seems to be a great environment. And that they also know how to party. So this was definitely the best party. They are directly followed, though, I must admit, by the one at Script. Script, if you remember, I had a contracting gig with them last year. And so naturally I checked out their party, and they have the ambition of having the best WWDC party every year. Well, they've been doing it twice and did a really good job about it. This year they had some, they call it giant hamster balls. You know, these are these sorbs where you climb in through a hole and then you have a big translucent ball around you. And that was actually organized. There's companies that you can hire. And so in the place where they usually have their ping pong table, they cleaned that out and had two of these sorbs people climbed in and they were hitting each other. So, yeah. There was a long queue, so I couldn't get there. So, really nice touch, Jared. Good for you. Unfortunately, Script has kind of retired the float reader where I had a part in. Actually, I was excited to find that it's still on the store because I thought they had pulled it. And it's more or less my crowning achievement. If you open the float reader and do a pinch on the text there, that's all my work. So just so if you don't know that, you can pinch on the text and contrasting to what a web view would do, you just actually resize the text in place. Yeah, that took really much work. It's based on core text. And the other thing, the other great thing that this does that I haven't seen anywhere else before is you can scroll vertically, but at any time you can also scroll horizontally and then it will automatically go into a paging mode. I think that that's really fabulous. Unfortunately, as I said, Float, they are retiring. They shrunk their development team quite a bit. And many of the people who once worked there are now at other companies. One of the engineers that was an intern with them while I was there is now in the Flipboard team. And while Flipboard, as you know, doing great things. By the way, speaking of Flipboard, these past few days, there's this talk about the CEO of Flipboard being asked to step down or something from Jack Dorsey, again, this Twitter guy, Twitter CEO. And the reason being, if you remember, I distinctly remember when Flipboard was launched, basically they said they are developing sort of an artificial intelligence that knows from your social network what kind of content you would be interesting and automatically creating like the perfect magazine for you. And if you now think, imagine, if you will, your current Flipboard app that's actually not smart or anything. It just pulls together all your feeds from Twitter, Facebook, content partners. So there's no intelligence in there. And it's my theory that this Flipboard guy is being asked to step down because both Flipboard and Twitter are going to attempt the same thing, namely to sort of use the social graph they have, in the case of Twitter, just the one from Twitter, in the case of Flipboard, the ones from all the network they look at, like Google Plus and Twitter and Facebook and Google Reader maybe. And what they can actually do is sort of treat the social networks as a neuronal net. So sort of as an intelligence to evaluate the degree of interestingness of articles for each user. So if something gets retweeted very much, for example, then that's something that becomes very important. There's one other example that points in this direction on the part of Twitter. You know, if something trends, yeah, sort of Twitter seems to be having, I don't think they just do it by means of words though. Like you need to have the hashtag retweeted a million times so that it trends, but they already have some sort of smarter algorithm there. And they also attribute an emotion to tweets. And where you can see that is in the Twitter API. There is a, in the search API, I think I saw it, you can actually search by smiley. If you enter a happy smiley in a search term, then it will look for tweets that have a positive emotion. And if you enter a negative smiley, you will look for tweets that have a negative emotion. So Twitter is doing some sort of artificial intelligence thing there as well. And they have more or less a kind of a stream approach. Yeah. So the latest thing where several iOS developers have basically said they stop working on Twitter's platform because for some restrictions. I don't know what they're talking about. But one thing that was recently released are these so-called Twitter cards, which allow website owners to specify some meta tags if they are on some sort of special VIP list that you can apply to. Then if one of your articles is being referenced from a tweet, then below the tweet it will attach sort of a preview and a preview image, and they call this Twitter cards. So that's a way, I think, how they are trying to make individual tweets more interesting. Like if you have a YouTube video, you see it in line right under the tweet, or if you see if there's an image, yeah, you see the image. So clearly it is Twitter's goal to increase the value of individual tweets for people. And in a way, they need some sort of artificial intelligence to achieve that, and lots of computing power. And Flipboard is kind of doing the same thing, but they don't have this stream layout where you have timelines, but rather they have this magazine layout. But down the road, well, I think what Twitter will want to do eventually, if they're not already working on this in secret, is to have a Flipboard kind of content aggregating newspaper personalized magazine thingy. Yeah, and so that's the reason why this thing happened with the Flipboard CEO. So yeah, well, the title of this podcast episode is WWDC, what next? Well, Apple has broken every previous year's record. While we were queuing for one of the lunchtime sessions, especially the J.J. Abrams one, where I was actually at the very front because I had a queue buddy who reserved the line position for me. At the front there was one of the Apple organizers, and he told us that the Apple gnomes are already busily working on the videos. So it was clear that they would become available more quickly than in previous years. Nobody, though, would have estimated that they would become available. I think it was Tuesday on the following week after WWDC. So that's totally amazing. Actually, I had some people even complain, well, for $1,600 or what the ticket costs, Apple should have held them back a little more and let us have the competitive advantage of knowing this content. But you know, WWDC is not about the sessions. You go there to meet people. You go there to network. I have a stack, I think, of like 2 centimeters of business cards that I need to do something with. That reminds me. So maybe send all these guys an email thanking them for their business card. And I don't know, send them a promo code. Well, promo codes I already have had on the backs of most of my business cards. So, well, maybe do something with it. But in any case, you want to meet the developers that you are reading tweets of throughout the year. It's just nice to have the face of the people, to see them once. And often it's kind of a warm and fuzzy feeling to meet people again that you just see once a year. And the other thing is, so networking, yes, that's the hall session, they call it, which also happens a bit on the parties. But the thing that's great about visiting WWDC every year is actually to get to spend some time with Apple engineers, those geniuses that make many cool things. And the other thing is, because of these parties that are going on, and Apple engineers are just human as well, you might also spot them going to these parties all around. And then you might also be able to have them speak frankly with you and kind of treat you with one or the other air code secret. Yeah, like I know, for example, from one of these sources that work on iOS 7 is already going on, because it seems that Apple's plan is you work right until WWDC, then the OS version is done, and whatever doesn't make it into this gets into next year's release. So that's iOS 7. iOS 7 already being worked on. Though, actually, that's not something really, really new and exciting. Everybody knows that Apple is releasing this every once in a year. But it's kind of interesting to have an Apple employee actually confirm that. Oh, well, off the record. Yeah, nobody knows anything. I might be totally making this up, yeah, just to kind of seem more important. Wink, wink. So we've got the videos that basically having the videos allows you to not go to the session during WWDC, because you probably can get more out of them at home if you make yourself a plan to watch one, say, every day at least, because there are 100 videos. So if you watch one per day, it takes you 3 months to go through all of them. And not just that, some of the sessions actually reference sessions from last year. Like there was one on GCD that I watched, and then it was constantly referring to the mastering GCD from 2011. Well, one day lost to 2011, because that's when I watched that, and it was kind of amazing the kind of things you, that are in GCD that you would have never seen otherwise. Like who's using IOQs? I've not seen anybody yet. They seem to be really amazing to kind of push the performance boundary even further, push the performance envelope. Well, okay, so we've got the Apple engineers talking, we've got the hall sessions, the sessions itself you get on video. There's another thing that WWDC does for me, I found. It renews my resolve to file better radars. Yeah, and it should do the same for you, because the thing that's really, really awesome is if you are in a lab and are speaking to kind of the expert on a certain technology. Like I was talking to a Cortex guy, and then I said, well, there was this issue, was this solved in iOS 6? And he asked me, well, what's the radar? Okay, I looked it up. I had it, of course, on my bug report thing. I didn't find it at first, because it had already been closed. Or was it a duplicate? Somehow it was no longer in the open ones. And there he basically glanced briefly at, they have such a really shitty radar app themselves. I pity them for having to use this. But in there he saw, ah yeah, that really was a bug and that was fixed in iOS 6. So yeah, well, it's that kind of totally awesome. You see something that you discovered, that you documented, you see that being fixed, but you actually see the person who probably fixed it. And he will say, yeah, good catch. Yeah. So that's the one thing. The other thing is I'm making a sort of a crusade that people file better radars, because if a radar is such that the engineer can immediately see, ah, that's something new that we haven't spotted before. A second thing, he has reliable steps that allow him to duplicate the problem. And ideally, number three, you have a sample code in there, then it will be guaranteed that it's helpful and they're going to do something with it. And another thing that one of these guys at the WWDC party told me, radars get never deleted. So even if they are open for years, they pile up and they never leave the system. So even if it seems that there's no action on something, and most of my feature requests, yeah, you can also file feature requests as Redis, they are open, and while they are not to be found in an Apple product, Apple will never say, no, we are not going to do that, or yes, we are going to do that. But it might be that one day you find that they actually implemented that, and then that will be the time when the radar can actually be closed. Otherwise, you will have a long list of open radars. Or maybe if somebody else thought about them, you will have them as duplicates. So that shrinks the list a bit. Yeah. And well, knowing that your radar is a duplicate means many people want the same thing. And if many people want the same thing, then Apple is more likely to actually implement it. It's sort of radars, when it comes up to a major release, it seems that radars are sort of a currency. Yeah. I'm thinking of it like this: the engineers are sitting around the table, and instead of chips, they have radars. Yeah, and then the one says, "I raise you issue X," and the second guy says, "I call you, and here are 100 radars for my issue," and then the first one says, "No, I've got 200 radars." Okay, he wins. This bug gets fixed. And that might happen, like, you have fixed release dates, and especially Apple they're not saying when, but I'm pretty sure they know every day they're going to release something for the next, say, 2 years, if not longer. So it will happen that there are issues that are known won't get fixed in certain releases. And so one thing that will probably happen with future versions of iOS, because now they can be updated over the air, that we will see more interim releases. Yeah. And so that is why it's now more important than ever before to properly document feature requests, give a good use case, why this is useful, what you are requesting here. And the other thing is bug reports. Especially now in Mountain Lion on iOS 6, I've got a couple of radars running on these. And by the way, that reminds me, somebody asked me if Mountain Lion is already ready to be used as a main system, to which I foolishly replied, yes, because I'm not using it as a main system. I have it on my MacBook Air, which I had at WWDC. And so I was putting it on over the Ethernet there to just kind of try it out. And it has some really awesome features for people who have IMAP email servers like myself. Though there's one showstopper for me in Mountain Lion, which naturally I filed a radar for, and I didn't get back as a duplicate, but I got some instructions how to turn on some debugging, and the resulting log file I attached to the radar, and so they're busily working on this. So it is quite likely, if this is indeed a system problem, and I think it is, because this problem I'm having, I'm not having with other devices or machines that don't have Mountain Lion. So most likely, by means of elimination, it's probably Mountain Lion's fault. And so, well, this gives me a good feeling. They will probably address this feature when they finally ship it, if they haven't done so already, and it will be in the next release. But the next release probably will be, I have a good kind of a certain inkling in this direction, might just be the Gold Master. So mark my words, today is June 30th. I'm estimating by the mid of July will be Mountain Lion will be released. And the one reason why I think it's foolish that I said yes, and I immediately added to this, on Mountain Lion, you cannot run iOS 4.3.3. You get a dialogue saying this is too old. You can only run 4.4 and 4.5. But as far as I'm aware, right now, you cannot use this to submit apps to the App Store, which essentially means you cannot submit something that you develop on Mountain Lion with tools that run on Mountain Lion to the App Store for release. Yeah. So heed my warning. If you want to put this on a machine, you better make sure you have a separate one, or like a build server, which we have. We have Jenkins as a build server to build it with a sort of air quote approved platform. Well, okay, Apple engineers, file good radars, file more radars. Sort of, if you find yourself filing a radar every day for 2 weeks or so, that's good. You should be doing that. And there's another side benefit. If you tend to think, oh, my radars, nobody ever does something about them, often putting sort of the problem, distilling it down to two lines of code or one view controller that is able to demonstrate the issue, often gives you a good feeling that it's not something wrong in your code, but it's something, it's a bug in iOS. And to know for sure gives you clarity, gives you a good feeling about your programming skills. And that's why you want to file them as radars. Not to improve iOS. Yeah, many people do that. You do that for yourself. Yeah, you do it for yourself that you file good radars, because it makes you a better developer, better programmer, if you are able to kind of take out the bits that don't work and make a demo out of that, and still be able to show that something's afoot with this code. And if you get a crappy response, which you also will invariably get from Apple engineers, like, can you please verify if this is also current as of iOS redacted? And you have poured your heart into this demo project and it looks like they didn't even look at it. Well, just kind of get the sample project, run it on this iOS redacted and send it back. I just tried it on my iPhone 4S, for example, under iOS redacted, problem still occurs, and it's back in their court. They will do that. Sometimes they are lazy. Somebody told me if they know you have a collection of Star Trek t-shirts, they will want you to burn them and send them proof that you now have a collection of Apple t-shirts for them to look at these radars. So that might be a bit sarcastic or overdrawn, but I'm thinking that's the best you can do. If you can honestly say these radars that you file, they are top grade and the samples are top grade, then, well, it's like 5 minutes trying them out and sending it back. Yeah, it's still an issue. It's the final word in closing a radar, if it's not a duplicate, is with you. There's this checkbox that you can check. If you see that something is actually solved, you can check this. Or can say you can close it now. Apple engineers will probably never close a perfectly good radar unless it's actually fixed, or if you're being a dick. So better not be a dick, file good radars. And by now you should have gotten my message, which is file good radars. All right, coming back to the topic, WWDC, what next? May I remind you that Apple has been known to do a Tech Talk world tour in many of the recent years. There was one last year. the year before then, I think they had a, they didn't do one, and the year before that, they did one. So it is very likely, and I'm looking forward to Apple doing a Tech Talk Work Tour in fall. If history is an indication, often it's not, but sometimes it is. There might be 10 European and international cities that they will visit. And, well, last year I went to the one in London, and it was cool because it was sort of a mini WWDC. I don't remember actually if they had labs there, but I think they did. But as usual, another thing that WWDC should actually prompt you to do is to, besides of the radar thing, file good radars, to actually start collecting good questions for Apple engineers. Like, if there's one thing that you can't really get your head around, yeah, put this in your Evernote or in your notebook, but better in your Evernote under a folder, WWDC or Tech Talk Engineering, Ask an Engineer, yeah, so that when one of these chances comes around, you have something prepared where you can queue for a few minutes to talk to somebody in one of these labs, and you have really good questions. And I promise you, you will be amazed of the experience of an Apple engineer actually explaining you these things. So Tech Talks, probably in fall. You heard it here first. Now, one of the things that Apple released at WWDC, it was kind of a first that they also released Mac hardware. Well, was it a first? Probably not. But for the past few years, if they were releasing something, it was iPhone related. Actually, I don't remember the year. Last year, they didn't release anything because the iPhone came out in fall. And the year before that, I didn't attend the year before that. So I wouldn't know, but I think, didn't they release hardware in advance to WWDC if it was like Mac hardware? So this year, something also cool to have been there because they totally refreshed all the Mac lineup. Reason probably being that it took until now for Intel to be able to provide the new 22 nanometer chips in volume and for mobile devices. And there are two variants basically, one with two cores and one with four cores. And the normal size Pros have the four core variant, and the Airs have the two core variant. But nevertheless, they have sort of a turbo boost mode. So the processors, like in the Airs, run around 1.6 gigahertz. But if there's demand, they can boost sort of the frequency to 3.2. So that's a new cool feature. Now, many people have right away tried to order. They tried to go to the Apple Store and queued several times in a row for the Retina MacBook. Like it is everywhere with Apple, you queue all the time. And many people ordered them online when at home, but I didn't. And let me quickly give you an answer why I didn't. For my regular work, I have a 27-inch iMac. Actually, I have two, one for me and one for my employee. And one contractor that works for me all the time has a big cinema display and a Mac Pro. So we don't have a need for a Retina MacBook. When traveling, even the Retina MacBook is far too heavy to carry around. And I was having an 11-inch MacBook Air that's 2 years old. That means it's like three generations old now with the new MacBook Airs. So what I did this time is the thing that I upgraded in size was the display. So I've ordered a 13-inch MacBook Air. It's slightly larger than the 11-inch, but I was kind of missing the number of pixels, because there's some situations with Xcode. If you don't have an external monitor, where you find that the resolution of the 11-inch MacBook Air from 2 years ago kind of smashes into a limit, and you have to zoom out further than is really nice. And so apart from this, I was also missing a SD card slot. The 11-inch Airs don't have these, so that was one reason to get a 13-inch. Then the 13-inch has lots more battery power, just because it's slightly larger. There's more space for the battery. So instead of around 4 hours, you get 7 hours, I think it's 7 hours of continued use. So if you kind of not use it all the time, you can probably get through a work day with that. And that's one of the other reasons. So if I have a need for a MacBook, then probably because I'm somewhere outside my office working. And then I want to have the maximum comfort while still having a certain portability. And the Retina MacBook is twice as heavy as the 13-inch Air. Apart from this, the new 13-inch Air, is about, I think I roughly calculated it to be 4 times as fast in terms of the CPU, because of the turbo boost and everything. So that will be a totally awesome addition to my collection of MacBooks. What will I do with the 11-inch Air? Well, I'm not going to sell any Apple hardware. My wife's going to get that. And she looks forward to that, because she's got like a really old white MacBook. And she loves the cute and cuddly 11-inch. There's another reason for getting a 13-inch Air instead of a Retina MacBook, besides of the price. That is, many people are actually tweeting that they are returning the Retina MacBooks to the Apple Store and getting the 13-inch Air, especially because of this reason that I mentioned. Because it's just the more mature machine. The Retina MacBook is sort of a design prototype from 2 years in the future, and the 13-inch Air is like, yeah, we've been doing that for 2 years now, and it's kind of now you have a new CPU generation, because the last two Airs have both had sort of the same nanometer scale of the CPU, and now this is kind of half of that, so it should run even cooler, even less power hungry, and if you need the power, you've got this turbo boost. So that will be a cool thing. And that's the reason why I'm getting a 13-inch Air instead of a Retina MacBook. Now, final topic. We've already been talking for 43 minutes. It's amazing. Never knew that I could talk so long. But, well, really, really much happened. And I didn't get much to prepare for my podcast. You know, podcasts are just a hobby for me. Even more secondary a hobby than writing tutorials on my blog. So if I have something to talk about, well, that's a rare thing. And I actually invite you, if you have something to contribute, actually, or would just like to chat with me on air, I'm thankful if you offer yourself, if you volunteer, because usually these kinds of interviews, I like to do them as a sort of interview. I ask a couple of smart questions and you give a couple of smart answers, and I record this with Audio Hijack and we end up having a show. So don't hesitate, you know how to get in touch with me. Ask me on Twitter or email me. Email is on the top right of my blog. Let's chat. So last topic for today, girls in technology. It's something that I kind of have close to my heart. I never had a sister. I never had a daughter, obviously, because I don't have kids yet. But I find I'm kind of one of these people who find that we don't have nearly enough women in technology. Like everywhere I go, you have a heap of guys, and there's a few brilliant individual women in technology, but you really have to go searching to find these, and that's a bit sad. So I did a bit of research and did a bit of thinking, and the reason that I've come up with why this is in our society, often kids are forced to make a decision as to the rest of their lives at a tender age of, say, 13, 14, 15, if they're lucky. Basically to decide what are you going to study? Yeah, what are you going to do? What college do you go to? So that you have it better than us someday. And the young people are basically forced to make a decision if it's not being made for them. Like their parents say, oh, you go to this college. And then the guy or girl says, well, okay, because you say so, I'm going to this college. And as long as I'm away from you, I love to go to college. I'm thinking it's actually would be better if young people, I'm intentionally calling them kids because with 13 or 14 years, they are not kids anymore. They're young humans. And I'm not calling them boys or girls because they are almost young adults. Yeah, because just a couple of more years. So let's call them young humans. Should be enabled to form their own opinion. Should be how do young people learn how to make their own opinion? Well, they have been taught a certain method of reasoning. Yeah, like have to, but in the simplest sort of make a mental list. What are the things I like about something? What are the things I don't like about things? And which side is heavier for me? Yeah, does the overall verdict mean yes, this is what I want? Or it's not what I want. And the other thing is to give them information. Yeah. And that's one of the contributions that I can do to society, and everybody who's in technology can do to society, is to more or less open his doors and let young people, regardless of sex, have a look what their profession actually entails. So that's one thing that I like to do. That sounds so cocky. Actually, I like to start with, because I'm only doing this iOS thing for 2 years now in full time. So what I want to start with now and plan to do in the future is to enable young people to form an opinion about development in general and iOS development in specific, to be able to have a basis for their own decision. And I would bet a sizable sum that if enough young ladies are seeing what technology holds for them, that they can be happy there, that it might even harmonize with some of their wishes and goals and likes, then more of them would decide to actually become programmers. And yeah, you know, we don't have nearly enough iOS programmers as it is. The market is growing in leaps and bounds. And I think we definitely need to have more females in this profession. For several reasons, I found females in development are the better team players. Often I find, especially with other men, even the ones that I work together with closely, often it's a matter of ego, where egos clash, you know. I'm thinking you should be doing this as a class category. No, I think you should doing it as a abstract class. No, you're wrong. No, you're wrong. So that's the headbutting that goes on when men are working together on one project. I've never seen that happen with females. For several reasons, I don't know. Might it be because they're submissive and they say, oh, yeah, you're right, I'm going to do it like that. But probably not, because I did this article on my blog where I looked at, I think, was it 17 or 18 female developers who are more or less in the iOS development area, and those don't really strike me as being the submissive kind. So if anything, this kind of shows that females who make it in technology are probably strong individuals and are probably experts at what they do and love what they do. And so when you have two developers who have about the same skills, and one is male and one is female, more often than not, I would assume that the female one would be the preferred choice for me, because she's just better at communicating, which is extremely important. If you're not like the backend programmer who writes server-side code and doesn't talk to anybody all the time and just has to read the spec, but if it's about communication, so what do you do, how do we interface, and so on, that's something that females can do really well. And the other thing is working on a team. It's something women just have this down, and I, as sad as it is, males usually find it harder to work together. Yeah. So, in the startups that I had a look at so far, it was always you had these stand up meetings in the morning. That was kind of the only a social thing these people would do. And then everybody would be sitting in front of his screen and code all the time. And contrast that with a developer woman that I met at Square, chatting at this party that I mentioned before. And what they do, for example, all the time, or most of the time, is they call it pairing. Yeah, pairing, short for pair programming. They have computers especially set up for that, with two keyboards and two mice. And so there are two people working at the same time. And so kind of, I can only imagine this to be chaos from my limited male perspective, and never having seen pair programming in action. But I got the impression from her, she's naturally suited for that. Yeah, so like really, pair programming is probably a women thing. I have to try it once. I'm trying it with my employee, because he cannot escape. Right? There is no escape. Resistance is futile. We're going to pair program now, dear Stefan. That's his name. So, well, it's kind of significant to me that I'm hearing about pair programming first from a lady, a woman, one that looked to be really a good developer as well. So, yeah, well, about girls in technology, I think one of the big problems is, even though probably non-intentional, but it seems that adults are still squeezing the young ones into certain roles. Like, I put in the show notes a tweet of Juliastic. Disclaimer, I know her. She's a cousin-in-law of mine. And next week, she's going to start sort of as an intern. Not really, because she's too young to really do interning. But, well, I'm doing with her what I said I like to do is to show her how development goes on, what I'm doing all day, so that she can evaluate, make her own decision if this is something she wants to pursue. But she tweeted, somebody told me that iOS dev development isn't a job with future. Is that true? And so I had to retweet that because that was kind of hilarious. But so there are two levels of communication contained in this. If somebody tells you iOS development isn't a future-proof job, yeah, this person is communicating two things to you. One is the facts. So the factual level of the communication is he thinks that iOS development is not a job where you can have a future. We can argue about that for quite some time. Proof, there's no real proof or anything because it's just an opinion. We cannot never actually talk about the future. We only know right now the market is growing like crazy. It's the only market in mobile apps where people are actually making money, real good money, where it's possible for one to three person teams to release a niche app and be totally successful with that. So that is the current present. And we don't know how long this will take. But if you start with iOS development, even if you don't strike it rich in this profession, it will still teach you quite a few things about development in particular. And these skills, they are not tied to the platform. If you develop the skills you need for developing, then you can take these skills to any other platform as well. I basically have kind of two areas here why I think Objective-C is a good language to start with. First, because it's C, and C is the basis for everything. Even Java has syntax that's very similar to C, if it's not for the objects. But C is also the basis for C++, and the kinds of techniques you use in C to increase performance, you can use everywhere. Like even shaders for games, GL shaders, are written in some sort of C dialect. So if you know C, you will have many, many options. And then there's the objective part from Objective-C, which is more or less object orientation that has been put on top of C. And there I can say from my experience, having seen C++, having seen a bit of Java, having seen Visual Basic, it is very simple to get into, even simpler than other languages. And once you get the concept of objects and object-oriented programming, again, the rest is just syntax. You can go to any other platform that has objects. You will have to relearn certain things. You have to adapt to the different kind of... You don't have square brackets everywhere as you have in Objective-C. But that's things you can get used to. And the core thing that I haven't mentioned yet when becoming a programmer is you have to have a certain skill, or you have to develop a certain skill in abstract thinking. And by this I mean you will have mock-ups, or in the least a mental picture of what you want an app to be looking like, and you have to abstract think kind of what are the ingredients that I need to get to this goal. And many people can't do that. Many people kind of just see something in front of them. And seeing is believing, but they can never dissect this mentally and think, okay, there's a button, so then I need to go into Interface Builder and drag a button onto something, and then there's some actions that this button does when I tap on it. And so it's this kind of abstraction level that you need to be able to achieve. So I'm not saying everybody is either a programmer or he's not, but for some people it needs a great deal of patience and training and sitting at it to develop this level of abstraction capability. And some other people are natural problem solvers, they see a puzzle and they delight in solving the puzzle. Yeah. So that's one thing that any young person looking at development in general and iOS development in specific is kind of developing an appreciation for this abstraction that's going on and being able to evaluate whether that's something that will give pleasure or will give pain in the midterm. So being able to decide. So that's the one thing. iOS development, in my opinion, is a job with a future because of iOS and because of development. Because development you can take everywhere and iOS will probably be strong for quite some time. But the second level that I was talking about that's also communicated here is, you have to imagine there's an adult and then there's a young girl, 15 years of age, and the adult tells the young girl, not really iOS development is a job in the future, but what he's really saying is, I don't think iOS development is a job for your future, because you are a girl and girls should be learning to become teachers or hairdressers or some other female kind of job. And I think that is really bad, that adults are just kind of blurping this out, hiding it behind something that sounds like factual, but in reality what it does is it gives this young woman a doubt. And if she's not strong enough, these kind of doubts will pile up over time and will dissuade her from actually pursuing a career in technology. And as I said, I'm a sort of on a crusade to see what I can do as a small iOS development shop to kind of further girls in technology. And I will celebrate the day, 1 or 2 days, 1 or 2 years in the future, when I can hire my first female developer. I'm really looking forward to that. But as I said, at present, it's really difficult to find iOS developers, let alone find female ones. So, to be continued, that's one thing. It's one of my wishes. Yeah, I want to be having a small company, small, like, say, 5 developers, where I can talk to the team, and if there's a bit of free resources, just come up with an idea for an app and tell them, hey guys, this is the idea I've had, what do you think? Do we want to make this into an App Store app? That's where I want to develop into. And if we can have women on the team, that would be all the better. So, speaking of WWDC, what next? We're going to be continuing to be watching the videos and counting the days until some faithful day in the fall when iOS 6 will actually be released. But until it is, we're just kind of doing the egg dance around the NDA, and everybody's watching what's cool and new in iOS 6, and some people are already developing components that have the same interfaces as new ones that are coming with iOS 6, just so that they can already program against the functionality, and then when iOS 6 comes, they just replace it with the real thing. So many things are happening. What I recommend to you is, even if you didn't have a chance to go to WWDC, you should still take on people's advice, watch the videos, file more radars, help more girls into technology, and not bullshit them about iOS not being something with a future. And so I conclude this week's episode for the of the Coconetics podcast. Wish you well, and we'll be seeing each other in 1 or 2 weeks when the next podcast episode of the Coconetics podcast will be coming out. Bye.